central U.S., as climate change is making large destructive wildfires more likely. Amy Held, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Tom Parkinson, filling in for Kay McIntyre on this Sunday morning. It's 4 minutes after nine. Former President Donald Trump has endorsed former State Attorney General of Kansas, Derek Schmidt, in the Republican Party primary for the 2nd Congressional District of Kansas. Trump said he was impressed that Schmidt was re-elected Attorney General by wide margins in 2016 and 2020. The Kansas Reflector reports that five candidates have entered the Republican primary for the seat being vacated by U.S. Representative Jake LaTourneur, who decided against seeking re-election to Congress. Officials at the University of Kansas Athletics Department say construction at David Booth Kansas Memorial Stadium is on track, and they say the new stadium is expected to be ready to host football games in about a year. The first game on the schedule will pit the Jayhawks against Fresno State on August 23, 2025. The Lawrence Journal World reports that the first phase of the renovation project has a price tag of about $450 million. It's targeting the north and west sides of the stadium. For this season, the Jayhawks will split home games between Children's Mercy Park in Kansas City, Kansas for the first two home games and GEHA Field at Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City, Missouri for the final four home games. The Kansas Department of Health and Environment is warning people to be on the lookout for blue-green algae growing in numerous lakes and ponds across the state. The KDHE issued an update on lakes and reservoirs that contain algae and issued advisories for numerous lakes and ponds, including Gathering Pond in Geary County, King Lake in Lyon County, Melbourne River Pond in Osage, Atchison State Fishing Lake in Atchison County, Cedar Lake in Johnson County, and Lewisburg City Lake in Miami County. The Health Department recommends that people take precautions in those lakes, any of those lakes affected by algae. Well, in sports, the Kansas City Royals lost to the Chicago Cubs last night in Kansas City. The score was 9-4. That series concludes this afternoon at Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City. It's 6 minutes after nine. You're listening to Sunday Weekend Edition here on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Tom Parkinson, and for Kay McIntyre on this Sunday morning. Coming up in just about 6 minutes, we hear from a pioneer in school desegregation in the Deep South about preserving a key piece of New Orleans civil rights history, the Lower Ninth Ward School that she helped to integrate back in 1960. That's coming up. Also ahead, early voting is underway in the Michigan primaries this weekend. A major question is who the party will nominate for the seat of retiring Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow. That's coming up in 15 minutes on Weekend Edition here on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from Kansas City PBS, offering family fun and learning resources with the 24/7 Kids Channel, and activities, games, and more at kansascitypbs.org/kids.
Next time on KPR presents, What Can Mother Earth Teach Us About Climate Change? Dan Wildcat of Haskell Indian Nations University will join us for a talk about his latest book on indigenuity. Kay McIntyre is your host for KPR Presents, 6 o'clock this evening on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which
constitutional obligation was to have a pulse.
There's no hotter spot in politics right now than the blank space underneath Kamala Harris's name on the ballot. I'm Scott Detrow. We take a look at three potential contenders for Harris's VP pick on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Check out All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 o'clock. Weekend, All Things Considered, comes your way Saturday and Sunday afternoons at 4. And tune in for All Things Considered during the week as well, starting at 3 o'clock from 3 to 7, Monday through Friday.
This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on After the Harvest, introducing UPP, or Urban Produce Push, with a goal to provide produce to the people and pantries in every corner of Kansas City. More details on how to help at aftertheharvestkc.org.
Two-thirds of heat-related deaths in Phoenix last year were also associated with substance abuse, most often methamphetamine. Now, health officials are trying to find ways to devise interventions. We'll hear more about that. That's coming up in 15 minutes. Next, though, it's time for the Sunday Puzzle with Will Shorts. Stay with us for that. Mostly sunny today. Afternoon highs around 92 degrees. Slight chance for rain this afternoon. Partly cloudy tonight with lows near 75. 30% chance for a shower after midnight tonight. Right now it's sunny and 78 degrees at 941.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR.
You can watch Amma's submission to the contest.com.
From Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
We are live and we're local. We're Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. We are KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. We're online at kansaspublicradio.org. Of course, you can always just ask your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from KU Spencer Museum of Art, now showing the exhibition Inked Bodies, which highlights the diverse stories people tell through tattoos. Details at spencerart.ku.edu.
Mostly sunny today with afternoon highs near 92 degrees. A slight chance for a passing shower this afternoon. Tonight, partly cloudy. Lows near 75. Rain chances increase to about 30%. Right now, we've got sunny skies. It's 78 degrees on the University of Kansas campus in Lawrence at 10 o'clock.
It can be hard to enjoy the natural world these days without anxiety. You notice a butterfly on a flower and you wonder why there aren't more. Climate change is hard on all of us, but especially on the world's smallest species.
And of course, once you start thinking about those insects, it just gets bigger and bigger. There are the crickets and the grasshoppers and the cicadas and bumblebees. I just think they're so beautiful and I want them all to survive.
I'm Ann Strangehamps, and these are the kind of spiraling thoughts we all have these days. The challenge is to live with that anxiety about the future of the natural world, but still find joy and refuge in it.
When I stand beneath a tree, my body physically becomes the tree's leaves. I find it so fantastic.
Today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, finding love in the time of extinction. First this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Israeli officials are promising retaliation for a rocket strike in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights yesterday that killed 12 children and teenagers. They blame Hezbollah, which the militia in Lebanon denies, NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports from Tel Aviv.
There's still confusion around what exactly happened, who's to blame. Israel is adamant that Hezbollah shot this rocket. The military's put out several statements saying that and offering evidence that this type of rocket and the explosives on it are only something that Hezbollah has access to. But Hezbollah has vehemently denied responsibility. In a statement last night, the group said very clearly that they had, quote, absolutely nothing to do with the incident. And several Lebanese lawmakers came out condemning the attack and saying essentially that Lebanon is clear on not targeting civilians, that Lebanon's not responsible.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Polls are open in Venezuela, where a big turnout is predicted in today's presidential election. For the first time during his 12-year authoritarian rule, President Nicolas Maduro is facing a stiff challenge by a united and energized opposition. NPR's Carrie Kahn has more.
President Maduro has a lot working against him as he seeks a third six-year term. Venezuela's economy is barely growing. Despite sitting on the world's largest oil reserves, production has tanked. Gas and electricity shortages persist, and political repression of opponents has escalated. Nearly 8 million Venezuelans have fled the country. For the first time in more than a decade, the opposition has united, mounting a strong campaign. 56-year-old Maria Corina Machado is leading the fight against Maduro, even though she's banned from running. The official candidate, an elderly, quiet former diplomat, is polling with a double-digit lead. The army has signaled it will abide by the vote count as well as Maduro's own son. Polls close at 6 tonight. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Caracas.
In the U.S. presidential race, Vice President Harris's campaign says it has signed up 170,000 new volunteers since President Biden endorsed her a week ago. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
The Harris campaign has more than 2,000 events planned in swing states this weekend. At a fundraiser yesterday, the vice president said this is going to be a very close race.
But this is a people-powered campaign, and we have momentum. The day after I announced my candidacy, we saw the best 24 hours of grassroots fundraising in presidential campaign history.
And the donations kept rolling in. The campaign says Team Harris raised $200 million in less than a week. To put that in perspective, that's four times as much as the Biden reelection effort raised in the entire month of April. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Republican Donald Trump campaigned in Minnesota last night, attacking Harris on crime and immigration. This is NPR News. Russian President Vladimir Putin is warning the U.S. that if it deploys longer-range missiles in Germany, Russia may station similar missiles within striking distance of the West. The warning came in a speech today in St. Petersburg to mark Russian Navy Day. The U.S. recently announced plans to deploy the weapons in 2026 to affirm its commitment to NATO after Moscow's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The lawyer for a notorious Mexican drug lord says that his client was kidnapped by another leader of the cartel. NPR's Ada Peralta reports the two members of the cartel are now in U.S. custody.
The U.S. accuses Ismael El Mayo Zambada of running one of the biggest drug operations in the world. Zambada was arrested at an airport near El Paso. In a statement issued to NPR, Zambada's lawyer, Frank Perez, says his client did not surrender or cut a deal with the U.S. government. Instead, he says Joaquin Guzman Lopez, another top leader of the Sinaloa cartel, kidnapped him. The lawyer says, quote, he was ambushed, thrown to the ground, and handcuffed by six men in military uniforms. Zambada, Perez says, was then tied to the seat of a plane by Guzman Lopez and, quote, brought to the U.S. against his will. Mexico says it was not involved in the operation. The AP reports U.S. officials say Zambada was tricked into coming to the U.S. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
California fire officials say the Park Fire is now about 12% contained. It's burned more than 350,000 acres. A 42-year-old man is to be arraigned tomorrow on arson charges. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantsFoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strangechamps, and it's the season for insects. mosquitoes and deer flies, wasps and bees and hornets and everything else we love to swat. I'm actually not crazy about killing bugs, and I try not to. But that doesn't mean I want to live with them in my house or on my porch. Maybe, though, I'm too quick to judge.
If we just get exposed to things sometimes, we can discover that they're not actually scary at all, that they're actually these strange but so elegant, delicate, and absolutely beautiful creatures that are living all around us.
This is Heather Swan, author, poet, and longtime friend of the show, also a beekeeper. And she's here in my backyard hoping to reintroduce us to some mutual acquaintances.
I'll tell you a story. It was one of those summer afternoons where a thunderstorm comes and drops a bunch of rain and then moves on really quickly. And all over my yard, the bees had been flying around. There were just bees that were wet in the yard and they couldn't fly because they were totally soaked. So I was picking them up and taking them back to the hive. Suddenly I had two bees in my hand at the same time, honeybees. They were both kind of taking their antennae and their legs and trying to sort of push all the water off of themselves. And their little fuzzy hairdos were all just kind of like, they looked like they'd just gotten out of the shower. And they were sort of caring for themselves until they realized that there was a second bee in my palm. And one of them even had a broken wing. It was torn a little bit. So both of them were kind of in a bad spot. But when they saw each other, they immediately went to start to caress the other and care for the other. And I thought to myself, human beings don't do that. You know what I mean? It was just this beautiful moment where they rose up out of their individual needs to care for their, I mean, we can argue that it's about caring for that community, which is a superorganism, so it's kind of considered one entity because those bees don't survive when they're by themselves. But it was just, it was so beautiful. And I don't know if you can call that love, but I can say that they do just beautiful things
it
together.
It was care.
It was care. Yeah, it was care.
These are tough times for people who care about the world's tiniest creatures. The global insect population is plummeting. Something like 40% of insect species face extinction, a terrifying statistic. The specter of ecosystem collapse haunts us all. And so here's the question we're asking this hour. How do you live with love and even hope for the natural world in a time of extinction? Some people are finding a way. Alfie wants to go back inside. Hold on.
Okay.
Heather Swan and I are getting settled on my back porch. We've got stick-on insect tattoos, I chose a praying mantis, and a copy of her new book, Where the Grass Still Sings, Stories of Insects and Interconnection. Heather teaches environmental literature at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her students are 18 and 20-year-olds, and she told me about a day when she realized just how scared they really are.
Basically, this woman said, this poem gives me hope. And I said, oh, tell me more about that. And she said, well, most of the time I don't feel any hope at all. And I don't want to bring a child into this world. And she said, but that poem makes me feel like maybe I could. And I said, oh, my goodness, you're nervous about bringing a child into this environmental moment? And she said, yeah. And I said, oh, my goodness, how many other people in the room feel that you wouldn't have children because you're afraid of the environmental things that we're facing? And all of them raised their hands. Hmm. I don't have any interest in pushing people to have children. It wasn't about that. It was that I realized that they were not seeing a future that they could imagine anyone surviving in. And so at that point, I thought, okay, they need more than strategies for change. They need to be able to dare to love, to have courage.
I'm really interested in the kind of conversations you're having with your students. Why don't we all have those all the time?
Yeah.
It's almost like we don't really want to talk about it because it's a little bit sad and a little bit scary maybe right now. There's a lot of bad news out there, you know, and if you start caring for something, it can be really painful. But I think that the other side of that is part of the reason that we're in this moment is that we've shut ourselves off from the natural world. We have this idea that we've been told for a long time that we're somehow separate from nature. And I can think of one moment is when Descartes says all the animals are machines. They don't have feelings. We've been coming back from that for a long time. But often when someone's pet dies, for example, we don't give the space for grief that we do for another human. And that maybe sounds horrible that I would suggest that there's some sort of equivalence there. But, I mean, I had a dog for 16 years as an adult. And when that dog died, Mojo, I remember feeling like he knew me in ways no human being knew me.
Yeah.
In nonverbal ways, in ways that were, like, it's, I love so much that your dog is talking to us during this conversation.
He's agreeing.
He's saying, yes, there's not enough attention paid. That's right.
So going back to those conversations, I was curious about your new book, that opening, the story you tell about, was it a year, a summer that you lived in a barn with your mother and your sister?
You know, it's so funny. I think we lived there 2 summers, but we were there for long enough to really get comfortable. It was a traditional barn, stone foundations.
Base, and then, and then it's like red timbers.
Right. It was a very porous building, and there were sort of these huge beams that went up, but all open. And so we lived there because it was a place that my mom found for us to live that was free. And the doors during the day when it was warm out, those would just be open. So we had so much wildlife coming in and out of the house that we were living in.
And how old were you?
I think I was about 9.
Okay.
9 or 10.
At 9 or 10, I would have been freaked out.
Yeah. My mother was amazing because she had this brilliant strategy of just naming everything. And so we had Winthrop the Wasp and Junie the June Bug. And one of the most amazing things was the bats that came in. We all had curly hair. My mother, my sister, and I had long curly hair. And when it got to be dusk, my mom would say, okay, girls, time to put your hats on. So we'd tuck our hair up inside of our hats.
You had bat hats.
We had bat hats. We did. And it was interesting because as she was naming all of them, she named the bats Angel and her family. And so all of the bats were just Angel's family. And we never thought anything other than that they were benign beings that flew in at night and ate the mosquitoes. And it was just such a brilliant strategy to name the things that would have scared us.
You think she did that really on purpose?
I think so. And so we really weren't afraid. And then when we would go out into the fields, there were all kinds of other creatures that were doing interesting, complicated things. And I just assumed that they all had lives that were important. And whether it was a cricket or a frog or a chickadee, but there were also coyote on that land, and they didn't seem to be other, really.
Do you feel like you ever lost that sense of easy connection with the natural world and other creatures?
I would say that what happens sometimes is that I've struggled with anxiety and depression for different reasons. And in those moments, I might feel disconnected. But I find that if I'm able to turn toward the natural world again, that's where I can find my healing. Yeah. And it's definitely where I take all of my pain that we have living in this moment. You know, when my father died, I was trying to make sense of that grief. At the same time, I was making sense of the pandemic and at the same time making sense of climate change and extinction and all the things that we have. And I have this very clear memory of getting in my kayak and thinking, okay, it was the end of the day. It was just the sun was going down and I thought, I'm just going to go out and be by myself. I'm just so sad. I'm just going to go
wallow in my sadness by myself. And I paddled out to this little island, thinking I was just going to be all by myself and really, you know, just digging into my grief fully. And I got there, and there were these three cranes on the edge of the water. And they were really curious about me. And I was watching them, and then I got closer to them and closer to them, and they didn't leave. And I decided to just stay with them, and they just had their evening habits of they were eating, and then it was getting darker, and I just stayed, and they allowed me to stay with them. And I realized that there was the sounds of the water around me and the sounds of the crickets beginning, and then some geese flew over and were calling, and then the cranes called up to them. And all of a sudden, it was this feeling that I wasn't alone at all. I was completely surrounded by so much life. That was, in some ways, this message to me about the continuation of my dad's energy, that he was now part of this larger continuum. That felt like family to me. It felt like being held by something. And it was so instructive to me also, because it's where I can always go.
You're making me think about this was not long ago, it was earlier this year, and I've been having a lot of trouble sleeping and just feeling really stressed. It was one of those nights, I woke up, I could not sleep, and normally I would maybe get up, wander around the house. For some reason, I just went outside, and I just sat on that bench over there in the dark, and there were owls, and they live in that big tree over there, and they were hooting really loudly. I mean, as I sat on the bench, it sounded like they were directly above my head. And that was so comforting. And I just sat there and listened to, you know, when you really listen to an owl hoot, that's such a deep kind of sound. There's nothing like it. Mm. I mean, I felt like I could feel it physically. Mm-hmm. And then there was this whoosh, silent right over my head. And I saw these huge wings, and another owl flew right overhead and joined the others in that tree. And then they all just hooted back and forth. Huh. And I wasn't scared, you know? It was more just magical, this silent flight and this huge wing spread. And when I went back inside, I was in a completely different frame of mind. Just totally different.
Mm. I can so relate to that. The hardest thing is just to let ourselves connect. Open yourself enough and quiet yourself enough that you could hear that and then feel it in your body, Anne. That's amazing, right? We don't make time for that. We're so separate. And I think that we could. I mean, I wonder if part of the reason we have so much depression and anxiety in our country right now is that we don't allow ourselves to remember that we are part of that wild world. We are also animals in this world, and that those voices calling all around us are part of this symphony that we can also be a part of, but we somehow separate ourselves from that. It's such a special sound.
It is. It's funny how many of those moments are sonic. Mm-hmm. Like that late summer sound of the locusts humming.
Mm-hmm.
Feeling like you're walking through sound. There's something about the sound of the natural world that just cuts right through all the other artifice.
Mm-hmm. It's such a part of our lives that we just don't acknowledge. I think that part of the reason that Rachel Carson's book was so powerful was because it imagined a silent spring, and what would that be like? The one danger is that if we don't know the sounds, or we don't know those beings to start out with, don't know, I think about it in terms of thinking about the sound. It's like, if you said, well, this symphony's great, but let's get rid of all the strings. Let's get rid of the woodwinds. Oh, we really don't need the timpani, you know? I mean, just like start taking it away, and yeah. It would really, we would be so impoverished.
I'm talking with poet and essayist Heather Swan about her new book, Where the Grass Still Sings, Stories of Insects and Interconnection. I'm Anne Strange-Champson. We'll be right back. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 89.7 Emporia, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for To the Best of Our Knowledge on a Sunday morning. This afternoon on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, our panel will weigh in on the top news stories of the week, plus musician and best-selling author Kathleen Hanna stops by to talk about her life as a pioneer of the punk rock and feminist movement, and then plays Not My Job. That's on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me today at noon here on Kansas Public Radio. Sunny skies, a high of 92 today in northeast and east central Kansas. Tonight, 20% chance of showers, partly cloudy, lows in the mid-70s. Sunny and hot for tomorrow, a high near 100, heat indexes as hot as 109. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
We're talking with eco-poet Heather Swan, who not only writes about insects, she also brings them into her classes. Undergrads who take environmental literature with her at the University of Wisconsin-Madison come face-to-face with more than a few insects and get some of their preconceptions challenged.
It's not that they all leave my classroom being in love with insects, and that doesn't happen, but I think that they are more willing to give space to them as creatures that deserve to be on the planet as well.
Like, they have to build up to feel like a connection with insects.
You do. They're the things that we are most afraid of, I think. When I talk about insects with students, I have them talk about an experience they've had with an insect, and most of the time, it's a scary one. And honestly, I feel like poetry is one way to really bring people into a closer relationship with the natural world. I mean, it's so funny to me that one of the poems that Mary Oliver wrote and is quoted all the time is a poem that ends, "What is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" But the interesting thing about that poem that no one really mentions is that the first part of that poem is Mary Oliver with a grasshopper in her hand, looking really closely at it. And I think that in some ways she's asking us to notice the things that are so small and unusual and beautiful about this life, and that in fact is part of the answer. And what does it mean to slow down and pay attention to these creatures that live such complicated lives that are so really beautiful, but they're small, and so we don't recognize them. We look at maybe a polar bear and say, oh, that's awesome, or you know, a lion, and we have all this reverence for these things that are mammals that are really huge. But when something is very small and it moves quickly, then suddenly it's something that we want to destroy. And so I think that part of inviting people into thinking about insects is my own love of them. If I express how much joy I've gotten through the years of spending time with insects, that sounds crazy to my students often. And then they get a little curious about it, and then they maybe open up to it. And one of my favorite stories is I brought insects into a poetry class a couple of years ago, and I had a student in there. She was a weightlifter. She was one of the toughest women I've ever met, mentally and physically. She was terrified of bugs. She looked like a person that wouldn't be afraid of anything, and she was afraid of insects. And we had stick bugs in there.
Insects. The ones that look like stick. Yeah,
they look like a stick, and they have long, pointy elbows, and they move kind of slowly. And this insect was walking all over different students that were trying it out, and they were saying, oh my gosh, that feels so cool, things like that. And finally, she said, okay, I'll try it. And so she put out her arm, and I let this little insect step down on her palm, and then it crawled all the way up her hand onto her arm. And then she said to me, "You have to take a photograph of this. You have to take a photograph of this." And so I took a picture of her, and she wrote to me later, and she said it absolutely changed her experience of insects. She had never wanted to be touched by one. She had a terrible phobia. And suddenly she had overcome a fear and discovered that it was amazing to have a little creature crawling on her arm.
When did you start liking insects so much? I know you're a beekeeper, so I know you've had a deep and long relationship with bees, but I didn't realize that it extends to so many insects.
Yeah. I think that when I was falling in love with bees and then discovering that there was colony collapse going on, and then I realized it wasn't just honeybees, it was in fact all of these native bees, and then in fact it was all kinds of insects. It was moths and it was dragonflies. There are so many galvanizing moments, honestly. I mean, being sprayed with my daughter by a crop duster was one that made me so angry.
What happened?
I was living in a community, and there was a moment I woke up in the morning, and there was a sound of an airplane that was flying, like it was coming down so close to the homes, and flying out, and then coming, like I heard it turn around, and it was coming back again. I still had 9/11 in my mind, and I thought, is this a person that's suicidal? Is this a person that is wanting to hurt someone? And I thought, weirdly, I need to get out of the house. So I grabbed my daughter, who was quite small at the time, and ran outside. And it was right at the moment when I saw that the plane was coming down right over the treetops. And I didn't realize until it was moving away that it was spraying. And I could feel it all over my body, and I could feel it in my skin and my eyes. And I ran in the house, and I, you know, was washing us off. And in 2 weeks, my daughter had a lymph gland the size of a mango on her body, and she was very sick. And as it turns out, people that were sensitive to this, people that have asthma, things like that, there was a letter that had come to the community before we moved in that said, don't be here or don't be outside during this spraying. And I remember feeling like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? We're spraying chemicals all over the community, including the people. It was a moment where I felt like, what is wrong with us that we're trying to get rid of one insect and in the process, getting rid of so many other insects in that same family, butterflies, insects that people actually like. And so that was one moment where I felt like, we're doing this wrong. And luckily, she healed from that. But my father died from Parkinson's. I just read a study that just came out in March that is naming more pesticides that contribute to Parkinson's disease. So that was a moment where I thought I had to speak up, not in a way that was condemning anyone, but to say, really? Do we need to be doing this?
You wrote at the beginning of this book that one of the animating questions you asked yourself was, is it possible to still have hope for this planet? And so we were talking about finding hope with your students, but you also went out to try to find people who are doing something.
Yeah.
Who's somebody you met who did give you hope?
Astonishing people. Honestly, there are so many people doing wonderful things. And one story is a woman named Maria Luisa Hincapie. She and her family decided that they were tired of finding out that orchids in Colombia, where they live, were being stolen out of the forests and that they were actually nearing extinction, many of these incredible orchids. And they decided that they would create a space, sort of a sanctuary for these native orchids. An orchid sanctuary. They bought this piece of land that was completely denuded. They described picking up the soil, and it was basically like sand that would just fall through their hands. And they just began slowly rebuilding an ecosystem from the ground up. And as they were doing that, different pollinators would arrive, and then they could start to plant the orchids. And the orchids, because they were native, needed a rich, rich population of pollinators. And now, when you go there, you walk through their forest of orchids, and they have all of these extraordinary creatures. I mean, what's interesting, too, is Maria, when talking about plants, she talks about them as if they are beings that have a life and a personality. And yeah, yes.
Does it feel different from the rest of the forest?
That space, to me, felt imbued with, I'm going to say it, Anne, love. It was beautiful.
One of the most magical passages in your book, it actually kind of made the hair stand up a bit for me, was you described the evening where you're hanging out with that family, and they asked if you wanted to see an orchid pollinated.
Yeah. There are certain orchids that they have to pollinate themselves. And what happens is you're basically opening up this creature and fertilizing. So it's actually rather sensual and a little bit erotic in some ways. Everyone was silent. It was so respectful and beautiful. And he was absolutely so delicate, taking this little tiny stick with a little soft end with a tiny bit.
It was just sounds sexual.
It was very sexual. He was kind of, in some ways, giving us an indication that there is this sort of this sensual, erotic exchange happening around us all the time.
The way you wrote about it, just, it sounded both sacred and, like, sacred sex.
Mm.
And I just felt like there's so much teaching in there, you know, you could almost learn from flowers.
Yeah, and absolutely, the birds and the bees.
Yeah. Going back to your students, your larger project is to bring them some hope, too, or help them find it in themselves. At some point, one of them said she wasn't sure she wanted to have children because of climate change. Can you tell me that story?
It was interesting because I thought about, in my own life, a moment when it took every ounce of courage that I had to keep loving something. And it was after my daughter was born. I had had a C-section that didn't go well, but my baby was brought to me and I was holding her in my arms. And what happened was she started breathing quickly, and her breaths were getting shallower, and they took her and examined her, and they realized that during the C-section, two holes had been punctured in her lungs. And so every breath that she took, a little pocket of air was building up between the lung and the chest wall, and that eventually her lungs were going to collapse. And the thing that I hate to admit is that in that moment when they told me that, the first thing that happened was that I thought, I have to prepare myself for her death. And that meant steeling myself against that loss. But I somehow realized that I needed to be brave for her. And what that risk was actually just loving her in these moments that she was with me. And so I turned toward that being, my daughter, and loved her, knowing that there was a chance that I would lose her, but wanting to give her as much love as possible in these moments when she was on the planet. And so I stayed with her and I watched as they did all of these things to her. They put her in x-rays hundreds of times. They put all kinds of tubes and wires in her body. But I stayed with her and I sang to her and I held my hand on her. And miraculously, both of us survived.
Oh, my God.
But the truth is that that moment, the thing is, it's very easy for us to turn away from something that might hurt.
Right.
And loving things can sometimes hurt. And so what I wanted my students to know is that in my own life, the decision to love things, even though it's hard, and even though sometimes it's very painful, allows me to have more joy, a richer existence. Because sometimes there is pain, but in part, it's because you're holding both of those things, you can actually have a richer experience of joy. And that when you're in the world and you're in love with it, it's really a great place to be. And so I tell them, please, please risk. Please have the courage to love.
Thank you so, so much. Thank you for the work, the writing you do, how much you help us open our hearts and love this place and what's around us a little more. And it makes me cry to think about you helping those students. I'm so glad you're in their life. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. It's been such a beautiful afternoon.
It has been.
Thank you.
That's Heather Swan, an award-winning poet and essayist. We were talking about her new book, Where the Grass Still Sings, Stories of Insects and Interconnection. Her most recent poetry collection is called Dandelion. Coming up, another take on how to find the courage to fall in love with the natural world, even in the face of environmental collapse. Biologist Andreas Weber's ecstatic philosophy of edible life after this. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 89.7 Emporia, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for To the Best of Our Knowledge on a Sunday morning. This afternoon on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, our panel will weigh in on the top news stories of the week. Plus, musician and best-selling author Kathleen Hanna stops by to talk about her life as a pioneer of the punk rock and feminist movement, and then plays Not My Job. That's on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me today at noon here on Kansas Public Radio. Sunny skies, a high of 92 today in northeast and east central Kansas. Tonight, 20% chance of showers, partly cloudy, lows in the mid-70s. Sunny and hot for tomorrow, a high near 100, heat indexes as hot as 109. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
German writer Andreas Weber is both a biologist and a philosopher, but that doesn't begin to explain how unique his work is. You could maybe call him a mystical scientist with a transcendental perspective on concepts like the carbon cycle and metabolic processes. He can tell you about the biochemical composition of a flower, but he's more interested in talking about what it might be like to be that flower, to feel the texture of the soil, to eat rays of sunlight. Andreas has a new book out in which he says life is all about eating and being eaten, which may sound gruesome, but as Steve Olson discovered, it's also kind of miraculous. The book is Being Edible, Toward a Mystical Biology.
So that's where I want to start. What does it mean to be edible?
Yeah, it might sound a bit startling at first. Being edible means being eaten, actually.
Yeah.
And the mutual edibility is, to me, one of the huge secrets of the living cosmos, that life feeds on life. And every life needs to live from life. So we could stop here and look at the food web and nature red in tooth and claw and all this. But I would rather go to this amazing realization that in order to exist, every being needs to continuously rebuild itself from the stuff of other lives. Mm-hmm. Life is about transformation.
So one way to think about this is, of course, when we die, we will decompose and our molecules or whatever.
And you know, I would really put it like this.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say we will decompose, because decomposing is actually a process of being eaten.
Mm, yeah.
I see it like this. When I die, I will be a feast for other beings. Like, you know, the roast turkey, mm-hmm. or the in Europe you have, in Germany you have the Christmas goose family tradition, you know, and you have this great day with your family, and it's just lovely to have this ritual in a way. And it will be like this. So there will be beings ecstatic about growing their bodies by transforming your body into theirs. And I find this absolutely spectacular.
Hmm.
So if we call it decomposing, we already have a very static look.
Or a very sort of negative look.
Very negative look. I mean, let's not hide that, of course, death is a huge challenge, but it also is always a rebirth.
There's another reference point here that I immediately thought about, and that is the Eucharist. Eating the bread and wine in the Catholic Mass, you know, which means you're becoming the body and flesh of Jesus.
Yes.
How directly are you drawing that analogy?
Yeah, I actually don't draw it at all consciously. Of course, I have realized how you could look back at the Christian idea or the Christian tradition of the Eucharist and more deeply understand that this is actually about life and about life-giving.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could learn about how to understand the divine in terms of a living reality, a living universe, a life-giving reality.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that your project is to take us back into our bodies, which is, maybe that's obvious, but it's not, because it seems like there's this tendency, especially in Western culture, to think of us as just minds.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole push of generative artificial intelligence. We don't need our bodies. At some point, we're going to download consciousness into machines, and this is fundamentally counter to everything you're talking about.
Yeah, it's true. That's why I also would really be careful by even using the word artificial intelligence, because intelligence, as I define it, needs a body. I think what we can see, actually we can see in the world and we can see in ourselves, is that every flavor of mind always has a material side. You are matter, and you're also the inside of matter, which I think is just an amazing privileged position. You know, I had this moment of revelation, actually, when I was, and I write about it in this book, when I was standing at the shore of the Mediterranean in one October night. I was in some residency in Italy, and there was a colleague, a filmmaker, I think she was a filmmaker, and she was there, and she was cheering at the waves. It was stormy, and the waves were crashing on the rocks, and she was cheering them on. And I was asking her, why are you so happy? And she said, I have no idea, but it makes me so happy. She just had a cosmic realization.
Hmm.
And I was thinking, actually, it is so crazily amazing that I am matter from this world, when I understand the ensouledness of everything. Then it's already like, you know, I'm conceptually preparing a mystical experience, actually.
Hmm. There's a beautiful passage you have in one of your essays. You tell a story about how you were sitting in a city park, soaking in all the sights and sounds, the birds, the trees, the wind. And then the outside somehow became the inside. Mm. And these experiences can be hard to put into words. But can you sort of walk me through that whole experience?
Yes. Yes.
Going into the park, what you were feeling, sensing all around you, and then what happened?
On that day, in that park, I met with a friend just to have a look at the early spring flowers. Early March, I think, or late February. So the time when in Europe these flowers who blossom only when there are not really leaves yet, they come out. It was just a sort of flower sightseeing. There were already some crocuses, I think that's the word in...
Crocuses?
Crocuses. And snowdrops, and I found it very beautiful, but that's far too shallow to talk about. I would say I had a pull which I felt somehow going to my heart, somehow pulling my heart somewhere. It was a sort of call, I would say. Come closer to what you really see here, these flowers, these blossoms. So I sat down and was thinking, okay, so I would try to somehow take them into my heart. beyond that emotional level, be very present and just sit there. In a way, I just resolved to do a meditation, and the friend did the same, so we didn't really talk a lot. We just sat down on some low fence. And then I was basically not doing anything but just trying to stay present. So I didn't really think. I cultivated something like asking, somehow being to be really, somehow be on the same level as the flowers in a way. I looked at the flowers, I looked at the branches which had no leaves and which somehow crisscrossed the pale sky. So it just popped up that I saw that all these connections of transformations, the flowers who drink the light and make their bodies from the carbon dioxide they breathe in, which I breathe out, this was some incredibly tender, intimate relational process. I was somehow part of it. I was somehow inside of it. I was somehow... It's a slightly psychedelic experience, actually. You somehow dissolve. You lose your solid ego, in a way. It was incredibly beautiful.
It's sort of like you've, I don't know, become... one of the flowers.
Yeah, it's a little bit like this. Yeah, you know, you really tempt me to try a little experience outside, because many people have had this experience, but it doesn't pop up so often if you do not cultivate it. And you can cultivate it, and then you can, I would even say you can learn to go into this mode of understanding this. But that's also part of my practice when I do workshops, to really try to open up for participants to walk into this perception, which I think has been the cultural norm for many ancient cultures animistic cultures, who didn't see nature. They didn't have a concept of nature, but they had a concept of other subjects, other non-human persons, other than human persons with whom they share their lives, with whom they could interact, with whom they could shift shapes. So we can really go in the direction of these experiences without taking any substances. You see, this has really become my passion.
Sure.
To do it totally sober, you know, teetotal psychedelic experiences, only helped by the flowers. I mean, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. So I want to ask you about where this perspective on the world has come from for you personally. And I want to go back to your childhood, because you've written about how at quite an early age, I think maybe even before you were a teenager, you became an avid gardener.
Yeah.
And this wasn't just going out and planting a few vegetables. This was more than that.
Yeah, that's true. That was actually, it was a philosophical approach to gardening. I'm still obsessed with perceptions which come from my early childhood, actually. It's this childlike wonder about reality, you know. Just looking at it and saying, wow.
How old were you?
I was maybe 12, maybe even a bit earlier. So it was on the other side of the street. Somebody had a garden there, and this guy moved, and the garden fell fallow. And I was looking at it, and I don't know. I just had this idea I could grow vegetables. And I asked my father if he could somehow talk to this guy, and it was a very low rent, actually. So my father paid that for me. But that was the only help, actually, he gave me. So everything was up to me, which was somehow a bit terrible, but also great, because I could do it as I wanted to do it. I bought literature. I spent my whole pocket money, you know, I spent on books, gardening books. In the wintertime, I made these drawings, which goes where, you know, where cabbage goes in that plot. And I was there every afternoon, I think. I had my little dachshund with me, and I also had a friend who was always helping. It was paradise. Only the attractive girls didn't look at me anymore. really, it was a high price I had to pay, you know. And at some point, I stopped gardening. So it became too serious. It was really, you know, I was this freak. You know, I was deeply in love with one girl for years in this innocent way, you know. And no, she didn't really look at me. And then there was this moment. I came back from the local farmer who had sold me 2 carts of manure. And I was so proud. Actually, he really, it was fraud. I paid far too much. I had no idea, but okay. I was proud with this cart full of manure, and I met this girl. She came with her bike, and she saw me, and I saw her. I was really hoping to have some eye contact and to show her my love through my eyes, and she looked at me, and I saw really my
this kid with a lot of manure.
My cause had failed. It was super humiliating.
Why do you think that was so magical for you? What was it about what you were doing then that made you obsessed?
Very good question, because then I didn't really know. It was beautiful black earth, wonderful earth, with lots of earthworms inside. There was also a blackbird who was also always there, and the blackbird wanted the worms. So the blackbird started to chide at me when I stopped turning the earth. That was very funny. And the dog also started to bark, because the dog had his own tunnel excavation project. And when I stopped, because I needed a break, because I was only 11, the blackbird started to screech at me, because he wanted more worms. And the dog also, because the dog thought I was kind of like leaving him alone in his huge building project. So it was actually very relational. And then I sowed salad and herbs and cabbage and beans, peas and carrots. And I mean, it was just wonderful and beautiful when in the evening with the sun setting, I was walking there and just looked at what was growing. I was gifted. I gave my labor and I was given back something, and that was wonderful. And then I could give this, obviously, to my family or to my friend's family, so we ate it also. That was also wonderful. So I would say I was just simply part of this circle of edibility. I made myself edible in terms of really toiling and sweating. So I really, really gave myself away into this. But then the garden gave itself away to me. This very short circuit of giving and receiving. And then I could give away that what I had received.
So there's something else that you write about in one of your essays that I found so interesting, and that's the boundaries that exist between the inner and outer world. So for the cell, it's the membrane. For a tree, it's bark. Mm-hmm. For vertebrates, the blood-brain barrier. Mm-hmm. The skin,
yes,
of the human
course,
body.
We have several of these.
Yeah,
yes.
And the point that you make is that all of these boundaries are both protective casings. They sort of hold what's inside. They're also permeable.
Yeah. You know, that came to me also when I met a tree in spring, and I saw that this tree in the forest close to my place in Berlin. We went into this forest like regularly with my dog, and it was early spring, and I saw that this tree, I really see it like today, that somehow the bark had opened and the green shoot came from this bark at a place where before there was only bark. I was thinking, life is just both. Life is a wall and it is an opening. Life is a refusal and it is an emphatic yes. And it is both at the same time, a wall that is a door. So it always means that living beings create themselves as being separate through being connected. You could even say that your respiration is this membrane, because what you do, now it's another instance of being super edible. What you do when you breathe out is that you breathe out CO2, carbon dioxide, and the C, the carbon in this, is your flesh. That's how it works. It's your fat, it's your protein, it's your meat. If you look into how the cell metabolism functions, what goes out as CO2 is part of the living being. You know, children are taught in school that we eat like cars are refueled, and then the food is burned, gives us energy, and then there's some exhaust. This is like biologically not right. It's wrong. It doesn't happen like this. It's because the food which you eat becomes yourself, becomes your flesh. That's the continuum. You eat the apple and you become the apple. You become the apple tree and you breathe out yourself. So this blue sky is actually made by the bodies of all these beings who breathe out every 2 seconds or even more often. And then you're breathing your body into the bodies of the trees and the plants. I find this so mysterious.
It's so beautiful.
We are one huge continuum of bodies. That's, for example, something you can exercise with participants in a workshop, just to do this very slowly, like a meditation.
What do you mean? What do you do?
To sit with a tree and breathe and see how your feeling is. And I tell you from my experience with these workshops is actually things happen. It's not just you sit there and breathe. Things happen. Like people come and sometimes people have this revelatory experiences. Like I had a participant in a workshop 2 weeks ago. She said, you know, suddenly I was the forest. People were walking through me, which is very profound, you know. On a certain level of our embodied nature, it's also plain truth. She had a deep insight in reality. People come back and they're so happy about them. But it's not so difficult to have them. You need some time. You need some patience. But I have become very confident that people can go very quickly, very deep, actually, because fundamentally, this is our experience. I remember last year there was a student, I did this for a seminar of a colleague at the Berlin University, and there was a student who looked at me and said, hey, this is actually like taking mushrooms. And I said, yes, but without taking mushrooms, you know.
Right.
It's just sitting with mushrooms. You don't need any object. You don't need to consume anything. You can just be it. And yeah. It's possible. It's possible. It needs some training, but it's in ourselves.
That's Andreas Weber, a biologist and philosopher based in Berlin. He was talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Being Edible, Toward a Mystical Biology. It's not out in English yet, but while you're waiting, check out his earlier book with an equally great title, The Biology of Wonder. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced in Madison, at the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our producers are Shannon Henry Kleiber, Charles Monroe Kane, and Angela Bautista. Our technical director is Joe Hartke, with help from Sarah Hopeful. And additional music this week comes from Martin Skelikons, Ketza, Kirk Osameo, Maiden, and Ergo Fismes. The executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge is Steve Paulson, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening. Be well, and come back often.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge on KPR comes from Pines Garden and Market, featuring a wide selection of perennials, trees, shrubs, growing supplies, and gardening advice since 1962. Open 7 days a week in North Lawrence. More information at pinesgardenmarket.com. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. Online at kansaspublicradio.org. Sunny skies, temperatures in the low 90s today in northeast of the central Kansas. 20% chance of showers for this evening. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Listening to people make music from rooftops and balconies and apartment windows has been one of the few bright spots during this pandemic. They started in Italy, spread to Spain and France, and now they're everywhere. Sometimes they make me cry. And I keep listening. Music has been important to so many of us during this crisis, as it has so many other times during human history. Once again, kitchens and garages and bedrooms have become our studios and stages. They're creative and beautiful. This hour, how to harmonize during a pandemic.
First this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Funerals were held in the Golan Heights today for 12 children and teenagers killed by a rocket strike yesterday in a soccer field near the border with Lebanon. An Israeli military spokesman, Rear Admiral Daniel Akari, says it's clear the Lebanese militia Hezbollah was responsible.
This rocket was a rocket called Falak 1. It is manufactured in Iran. It is delivered to Hezbollah. Hezbollah is the only terror organization in Lebanon that holds Falak 1.
Hezbollah denies involvement. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said today there is every indication the rocket was from Hezbollah. He said Israel has a right to defend itself, but the U.S. does not want the conflict to escalate. Former President Donald Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance rallied supporters in central Minnesota last night. Mark Sedeklik of Minnesota Public Radio reports.
Thousands of people packed into a hockey arena on the campus of St. Cloud State University to hear from Trump, who often had his audience standing to applaud as he ripped Democrats on the economy, public safety, border security, and foreign policy. Trump ridiculed and mocked President Joe Biden, even though Biden dropped out of the race and endorsed his vice president, Kamala Harris. Trump also spent plenty of time criticizing Harris.
Ultra-liberal Kamala Harris will deliver crime, chaos, mayhem, and death to our country. I will restore law and order, justice in America.
Trump's pick for vice president, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, was also at the rally. Vance accused Harris of covering up Biden's state of health. For NPR News, I'm Mark Sedeklik in St. Cloud, Minnesota.
Today marks 100 days until the election. The Harris campaign says it's raised $200 million and signed up 179,000 new volunteers in less than a week. President Biden is scheduled to travel to Austin, Texas tomorrow to commemorate 60 years since the Civil Rights Act was signed by President Lyndon Johnson. From member station KUT in Austin, Katie McAfee reports.
On the surface, this looks like any other presidential trip. Biden is expected to deliver remarks on the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. And he'll be joined by activists, including actor Bryan Cranston, who has portrayed LBJ. But this has been anything but a typical presidential election year. The twice rescheduled appearance will be one of Biden's first since dropping out of the race. And he will speak at the Presidential Library of LBJ, the last sitting president to decide not to seek re-election, back in 1968. For NPR News, I'm Katie McAfee in Austin.
This is NPR News in Washington. A new law takes effect in Iowa tomorrow. It bans most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. Iowa is the latest state to curtail access to the procedure since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade 2 years ago. In her first day of competition at the Paris Summer Olympics, American gymnast Simone Biles appeared to suffer a minor injury to her left leg, but she went on to complete the rest of her routines. Biles finished the qualification round in first place in the all-around standings. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports.
Biles started the day with a terrific routine on the balance beam, but then when warming up for the floor exercise, she appeared to hurt her lower left leg. She had it wrapped up in thick athletic tape, then went on to finish the rest of the competition with routines on floor exercise, vault, and uneven bars. Still, Biles walked around the arena gingerly. At times, she limped. Afterward, her coach, Cecile Landy, downplayed the injury, calling it a, quote, little pain in her calf. With Biles' performance and strong showings by teammates like Sunisa Lee and Jordan Chiles, the U.S. women have qualified for the team all-around final on Tuesday. Biles' coach said there is no question at the moment that Biles will compete. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Paris.
Canada's Minister of Sport said today the government will withhold money from Canada's soccer officials next year. They were suspended by international soccer officials for using a drone to spy on the training sessions of an opponent at the Olympics. A statement from the minister says the incident has caused significant distraction and embarrassment. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. on the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
At the height of the coronavirus pandemic, this is the sound that went viral. This is neighbors in Siena, Italy, at home alone, but singing to each other across the street. I'm Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. You know, music has been one of the few silver linings during this whole horrible experience. Live stream concerts, rooftop sing-alongs, people all over the world are finding new ways to make music together, even under community lockdowns. It's almost like we need to sing.
Singing is something that the body does, and we don't have a way to be with each other in our bodies right now. And that's a profound loss, I think.
Lisa Bialava is an award-winning composer and soprano. She's been inspired by the coronavirus crisis to create something new.
It was the result of a private brainstorm that had to do with how to build community in this particular situation. I mean, for me personally, I live by myself. I live a block away from the largest hospital complex in Upper Manhattan. And I don't have access to other people. And I know that there are many others in the same situation. I started getting sort of texts from various friends and colleagues that I thought, wow, this is really so beautiful. I want to set this to music.
The piece is called Broadcast from Home. It's a large-scale, crowdsourced composition based on testimonies that Lisa collects online. She sets them to music and then gets people to sing and record them from their homes.
Part of what I'm doing, of course, is listening to the voices of people singing in their homes. Every morning I wake up, it's like Christmas.
Your entire process for this work is collaborative in a way I've never really heard of. Could you just walk us through the different stages?
Sure. Well, I mean, the very first thing that happens is that people go to the website and you can share your testimony there and you can type it in, you can upload a document, you can speak it in and upload a sound document or a video. Mm-hmm. And then I write these small phrases.
But this isn't finished music. These are little musical thoughts.
Right, right. Like, more than a week. And that's it.
And so then somebody listening can just sing more than a week back to you.
Exactly. If that weren't from chapter one, I could have like used your phrase just now.
And then you layer people's voices.
I do.
So when we hear the final work, it's not just you singing.
Oh, no. I've already had like 50 people involved or something.
So anyone listening right now.
Anyone listening right now.
Can become part of this new work.
That's right.
Okay, this one you can sing on any note at all. And the words you're going to sing in this rhythm. That other you still exists.
The very first broadcast from home was actually a text that I got from somebody that I know.
What was the text?
It was a woman who was basically talking about how she's wondering, like, why am I not reading or doing music, or why am I not cleaning closets? All those indoor things I love to do. How come I'm not, you know?
After more than a week.
It's been more than a week. I'm at sixes and sevens. She described, I didn't set this text, but she described sort of like laying in bed for a whole day. And she was basically saying, you know, that other you still exists. It's not forever. Just give in. Chapter one, that other you still exists.
That is just haunting.
Thank you. The thing that strikes me about these testimonies is that each week there's a different kind of a distilled kind of emotional state that many people must be feeling.
So you're kind of channeling and giving voice to emotions, collective emotions.
Yes.
How have those emotions shifted as the pandemic has gone on?
Well, it's already shifted. You know, chapter one was that I just described and that you just heard, that had to do with sort of surreality and just sort of the lurching, just shifting gears. By chapter two, there are already people who have, that I know, I have already lost somebody. So the second one, Tiny Powerful, is dedicated to this friend of mine that I hadn't seen for years that I learned had passed away. And I'm starting to see that in the testimonies. I mean, the text is somebody who lost her own parents years ago. She's remembering what it was like to be with her loved ones when they were terminally ill, and is meditating on the fact that families can't be with their loved ones. And it's just so touching. But there were parts of her testimony that I couldn't set because they were too searing.
Very slightly hard to listen to, I found.
Yeah, I understand, yeah.
I also feel guilty about saying that.
It was hard to work on.
Yeah?
It was hard to work on. I mean, I guess maybe for me, I felt that what I was doing with the second one was I was meditating on these things that families can't do for their loved ones as a way to sort of re-offer those things into the collective imagination. Right now, I'm working on chapter three, which you can't hear yet, but it's kind of caustic and sort of disgruntled. It's actually kind of funny. That's coming in, too. All of it's coming in.
What would you say the mood is now?
Well, you know, obviously there are always concurrent moods.
Mm-hmm.
But I found in three or four of these testimonies, I found people who were just irritable. And I feel it when I go grocery shopping, too. People snapping at each other because they're standing 5.5 feet away and not 6 feet. It's actually probably fear that we're feeling, right? But people are irritable, and it's kind of funny, you know? It's just like people trying to make sense of how just bizarre things are now.
Mm.
On this one, you can sing any of these phrases very fast on any note you want, or you can add your own disgruntled phrase, something like this. I'm annoyed that all the rich people have left.
I'm annoyed that all the rich people have left. They should have to suffer here with the rest of us.
Why are people hoarding and wasting?
Why are people hoarding and wasting? Careless people in their 20s and 30s aren't wearing masks and won't stand far enough away.
It's just like, that's a mood too. This is how we can minister to our communities.
Can you tell me more about that? In what way music for you is a ministry?
Yeah. Composers from, you know, at all times would have felt this way. This is what we do. We spend our whole life learning to do these things. It has to do with honoring. That's what it feels like. I feel like I'm honoring people's experiences right now.
Sounds like a form of prayer, almost as though we're listening to many, many people's most private, most intimate prayers.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm listening and I'm humbled. It's very tender to be seeing all of these beautiful, lovely voices, so many different kinds of voices, different ages. I can tell in the grain of these voices, I can tell that some people are quite old, some people are quite young. I see that they're coming in from South America, from Kenya, from the UK. You know, I can hear the accents in their voices when they're singing the words.
I guess I'm wondering, does it make people feel worse to listen to music that's filled with grief, or is there something actually healing about that?
Look, it's true that it could be quite painful to sit with one's pain in a musical, painful, grieving space. It's also true, I know for me, that I find it quite painful to talk to people or to have interactions with people that feel fake and that don't have the depth of experience that we're all going through. Yeah. I really can't kind of just pretend this isn't happening as an artist or as a person. Maybe some people can, I don't know. And maybe I can sometimes, but I can't all the time. I want this project to be able to go wherever we're going, no matter how difficult that is.
So far, this is a work in progress. How will you know when it's finished?
Well, that's, you know, one could ask the same question, like, when will we know we can go back to normal life, you know?
Do you anticipate someday hearing it performed in public?
Yes, I do. But one of the things I've decided is that even when it is performed in public, I want just voices singing the parts that were originally sung by people at home. I want there to be actual, authentic, recorded voices blended in with live performance. It is an archive.
Yeah.
It's an archive.
This phrase you can sing in either octave. I don't need to ask you if it's over yet. It's gonna take more than time.
Lisa Bialava is an award-winning composer and vocalist. Her new work about the coronavirus is called Broadcast from Home. And if you would like to sing a melody for it or write a testimony, Lisa is welcoming TT Book listeners to join. Go to ttbook.org for instructions. We've been digging through our own music archives this week, and we found some wonderful in-studio performances and interviews. Reminded us that there is nothing like being there for a performance. I'm sure concerts and music festivals will be back at some point, but for many of us, never again to be taken for granted. In the meantime, from the TT Book Studios in 2005, here's the Finnish a cappella group, Fartinia.
Is there one more song you could do for us before you go?
Yeah. What should we do? About Aitara? Yes, we are singing a song about washing clothes. Those days when we didn't have washing machines. This is called Aitara.
Oitara, aitara, lähtä liikat laiturille. Oitara, aitara, lähtä liikat laiturille. Oitara, aitara, liinat huivit liottaa. Oitara, aitara, liinat huivit liottaa. Oitara, aitara, parrat paijat pesemään. Oitara, aitara, pyykit pyöritellään. Oitara, aitara, liinat liotellään. Oitara, aitara, suopas ilotellään. Oitara, aitara, vesi valutellaan. Oitara, aitara, oitara, aitara, oitara, aitara, oitara, aitara, oitara, aitara, oitara, aitara, oitara, aitara. Kun on liinat liotettu.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the Finnish a cappella group Vartinia. Coming up, more music recorded live from the TT Book Studios. Country music, jazz, beatboxing, and stuff I can't even begin to describe. Like the sounds of Bobby McFerrin's own body. I'm Ann Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for To the Best of Our Knowledge here on a Sunday morning. Next time on KPR Presents, what can Mother Earth teach us about climate change? Dan Wildcat of Haskell Indian Nations University joins us to talk about his latest book on indigenuity. Gay McIntyre is your host for KPR Presents, 6 o'clock this evening here on Kansas Public Radio. Sunny skies, temperatures in the low 90s today in northeast and east central Kansas. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows in the mid-70s, 20% chance of showers. The summer heat returns on Monday, sunny and hot with a high of 100. Heat index is as hot as 109. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
So we made a house concert for you this week, featuring interviews and performances recorded live in our studios. An obvious choice was Steve's interview with the great Bobby McFerrin. He's famous for his smash hit, Don't Worry, Be Happy. But McFerrin has done a lot more than that. Here's a snippet from where he and Steve are talking about an 8-year project he just finished called Vocabularies.
Now, I'm curious, when you look back over your career, and as you were starting out, was there a breakthrough moment for you when you felt like you found your voice, you found your distinctive way of making music?
Well, the divinely appointed moment for me to discover that I was a singer, I don't think it could have happened any earlier or later. I think that on July the 11th, 1977, I remember the day. I remember where I was. I remember the weather. It was a sunny, sunny day. I remember deciding I'm a singer. And it's a 25-minute walk from school to my home. And by the time I get home, I'm convinced that I'm a singer. I don't know how these happen, but I'm sure the angels in heaven were clapping their hands because I finally figured it out. I called up the Hilton Hotel, and the manager, who was never, ever there, picked up the phone. And I had an audition. He said, well, come down tomorrow. And so I went the next day and sang 5 songs because I only knew 5 songs. You Are the Sunshine of My Life was one of them. And another tune was, come down off your throne and leave your body alone. But a tune by a group called Blind Faith with Eric Clapton. And I sang 3 others. I don't remember what they were. Oh, a tune called Opportunity. Ba-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee. Opportunity came to my door. By Joan Armatrading and 2 others. And he hired me. And I started working a month later. And that was my first gig, was a piano bar gig. And I did that for about 1.5 years.
That's extraordinary. Yeah. I mean, to hear that it was, that you can pinpoint the day. I mean, it's sort of like the day that was to some degree going to set the rest of your life ahead of you.
Yeah, it was. It was indeed.
I mean, not many people can say that their their life sort of changed on a particular day.
Yeah, so July the 11th is, you know, like a birthday to me.
That's 10-time Grammy Award-winning jazz vocalist Bobby McFerrin talking about Vocabularies with Steve Paulson. And hey, if you want to hear the full interview, we've got it online at ttbook.org. And now, another vocal virtuoso.
Hello there, everybody. This is Moken, and right now we're going to play Unla from Missing Chapters.
This guy's name is Mokin. He's from Cameroon. He's a musical storyteller with a voice like nothing you have ever heard. Charles Monroe Kane sat down with him earlier this year to talk about his new album, Missing Chapters, and to hear some music.
Una. 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 Una manjolini, 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 manjolini.
Fishermen had gone fishing, and they caught all the big, big fishes, but decided to sell it to the neighborhood richer village beside the stream by the river. They didn't come back. Six strong hearted boys and the hungry village standing beside them, waiting, watching, watching, watching. Six strong hearted boys. Everybody's waiting.
What am I listening to? Is this traditional Cameroonian Makossa music? Is this jazz? Is this Afrobeat? I mean, is it something else? Is it experimental? I mean, what kind of music is this?
The bass foundation, that is the bed of the song, is the African rhythm.
Right.
You know, I'm fusing it with influences from Take Five. I'm fusing it with some kind of ballad.
Was there a time in your life, young man, where you're like, okay, here's some different tribal music, here's Afrobeat, here's some French music, here's some Motown from America? It's like, I'm going to put all this together. No one else is doing that around you, I assume.
No, not really. I love almost everything. When I go to a Makossa party, I know that I'm just going to go enjoy my Makossa bed. You find me the next Saturday nightclub, I'm going to the nightclub to listen to Bob Marley, to listen to James Brown. Then when I came to Detroit, there was a season that I only listened to rock and roll, classic rock. For some reason, I'm some kind of like a human music recorder. You know, I record those things and they store inside me, and every song demands which aspect of those influences will come out.
Oh, interesting. So wait a minute, you're running around basically the world, soaking up as a recorder all the different music, and you're bouncing around. There's a lot of music out there. Did you hit a genre and you're like, no, that sucked, I'm not going to include that in my recording?
I don't think, that's a good question. I don't think, you'll be surprised that there was a season that I was only listening to Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton.
Oh, there you go. Then you're proving you're listening to it all. If you bring Kenny Rogers into the story, then you listen to everything. I will tell you. The influences of the gambler on the music, we'll have to talk about that later. That's a long discussion over a couple of drinks, I think. So you're a young man. You're from the Bassa tribe, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Are there animosities? Like, if you're Bassa and there's traditional music from there, like, and everyone can hear a Makossa, are you allowed to play anything you want? Or is there some people that looking down on you and say, hey, man, you know, that's not appropriate to play that?
I am almost not happy with typical Cameroonians, because I picture Cameroonians, those typical Cameroonians who are so narrow-minded, who only want to listen to Makossa. I picture them like a family sitting in a living room and there's a library shelf with the best new books and nobody's touching that book.
Hmm.
And the only stuck with the kindergarten book that everybody's familiar with. But I think there'll come a time, maybe even from now on, from this show, from TD Book, Cameroonians are gonna, they're gonna open their eyes and say, wow, they're gonna end up listening to my first album and this album. Then they're gonna see those pint of high life, those little pint of Manu Dibango influences. Then they're gonna embrace it. That's why my music is more embraced right now here in America. And,
right.
You know, it's going gradually into Canada and UK.
I want to talk about your voice, not like in a metaphor, your voice. I mean, like literally your voice. It is so unique. I listen to both your albums and it's just insane. You talk, sing, you use falsetto, you're baritone, you employ vocal fry, you chant, you tell stories, you warble. I mean, you scream and cry. Like, do you see your voice as a weapon or is that meant to seduce us?
Oh, thank you. I see my voice as a serious harmonic weapon. I think the voice is more powerful than a bullet.
Well, who taught you to do this?
Nat King Cole taught me how to do this. Frank Sinatra taught me how to do this. Van Morrison taught me through their music. Paul McCartney, yesterday. So I'm like, wow. So it would be cool if when I'm singing a song, just as I'm feeling, if the feeling is very low, I take my voice low. If the feeling is high, I take high. If the feeling is just midway, I take it midway. If there's a part in the song where I want to surprise everybody, I just laugh or I, you know, it's a part of the song I want to be funny. So I notice that it's all working.
Right.
So
hey, wait. I have a question. I'm hearing you talk about they're combining all this. So 30 seconds. Give me 30 seconds. Take us on a journey of the range of your voice. Like, kind of just give us an example.
You know, darling. Tell me. Okay, let me start with this song. Pretend you're happy when you blue. It isn't very hard to do. Darling, you are always needed on your tenderness. Sherry. Lama bong. Love and bone. Bésame mucho. Bésame. Chéri, si tu m'aimes, il faut rester près de moi chaque jour. Chéri, si tu m'aimes, il faut rester près de moi. Hi. I love you, girl. I really want you, girl. You know, one day you will come in my life. I'll be hugging you. I'll be holding you. I'll be walking with you. I'll be walking with you. Shall we? All right, now. You're smoking.
Dude, I gotta tell you, man, I have a clap for you for a second. That's fantastic.
Thank you very much, Charles.
If I could wake up to that, I would know the possibilities of my day, right? I could do everything I wanted. Hey, I'm gonna have you play one more song for us to go out on, but I want to ask you a question before we do.
Yeah.
I was reading a bunch of reviews of your albums from all over the world, and I was reading reviews, and everyone bends over backwards to describe your music by comparing you to someone else. Let me give you the names, how people compared you. Van Morrison, Bob Marley, Miriam Makeba, and many, many times Nina Simone. That is a hell of a list. Who do you say you are?
I'm not any of them. I am Moken. I'm not any of them. I believe that I am the next kind of Bob Marley, but not a Bob Marley. I'm Moken. You know, I'm not any of them. If I identify only one of them, then I'm going to lose myself. I am me. But I thank their spirit for really creating me, creating my voice.
Well, Moken, why don't you take us out with one more song?
Okay. This is Sing the Song.
Mokeen, playing from his album Missing Chapters, Charles Monroe Kane sat down with him. Resampling music recorded live in our studios this hour, and there's more. We put together a playlist of all the songs played live in our studios over the years. It's a pretty eclectic mix. Listen at ttbook.org and share. And then, I don't know, maybe listen again. I'm Ann Strainchamps. This is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for To the Best of Our Knowledge here on a Sunday morning. Next time on KPR Presents, what can Mother Earth teach us about climate change? Dan Wildcat of Haskell Indian Nations University joins us to talk about his latest book on indigenuity. Gay McIntyre is your host for KPR Presents, 6 o'clock this evening here on Kansas Public Radio. Sunny skies, temperatures in the low 90s today in northeast and east central Kansas. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows in the mid-70s, 20% chance of showers. The summer heat returns on Monday, sunny and hot with a high of 100. Heat indexes as hot as 109. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
We're back to our favorite music interviews recorded live in our studios. One of Charles's favorites was with country music star Brandi Clark. Brandy and Charles had a similar kind of upbringing, and he felt a really strong connection with her album Big Day in a Small Town.
For me, I sat down, I have a screened-in back porch where I live, and I have a record player out there, which is great, and I played your entire album without stopping. By myself, laid down, had some cocktails, sat there by myself, and I was really struck about women. True tales of the idea of what it'd like to be a woman, not a woman who's in conflict with a man, or who wants to get a man back, or who's smashing up a pickup truck, she's pissed off at a man. But the voices of real women, that to me was unique.
Wow. Well, I guess that means there's a lane for it then, you know? Yeah. Yeah, I think what happens to me a lot is when I play live, and it's always the highest compliment, is a woman or multiple women will come up to me and say, wow, how did you get a hold of my diary? And that makes me feel good, because even though those stories maybe aren't being heard, it doesn't mean they're not happening and that they don't need to be told and heard. And for them to be heard, they have to be told first. And so I'm trying to tell those stories for those people who aren't singers and writers. That's not their gift. You know, they're getting through life doing something else, but they like to turn on music and feel like somebody understands them.
These women on your albums, you know, the bored housewife getting high, a jilted lover, the aging homecoming queen, the hairdresser, which I found amazing, the woman with three kids and no husband. Do you know these women?
A lot of them. You know, you mentioned the hairdresser. My hairdresser's named Sherry, and she was sort of the inspiration for the beginning of that song Soap Opera, because she knows more about me than almost anybody. You know, your hairdresser's sort of like your therapist in that you can tell them a lot of things. And three kids, no husband, I think everybody knows that person. And that song in particular, that hits people a lot harder than I ever really thought it would. I underestimated the power in that song.
When she smokes the cigarette on the porch, when she has a moment break on that song, I cried. Because I totally get it. You know, I can imagine what that moment is like for her. I'm married, and I'm stressed out, and I'm trying to help my kids with their homework and all these things. And I'm like, my God, I only have two kids. She has three. And she's on her own, and I just think about her smoking that cigarette. I feel for her. Can you play that one for us?
You bet. I'd love to.
All right.
She's got three kids, no husband, and she's 2 weeks late on last month's rent. She's waiting on the child support. He keeps swearing that it's coming. But if she knows him, she knows where it went. And that pile of bills ain't gonna pay themselves. It's been a 40-hour week, and it's only Tuesday, and there's homework and dinner. Somebody wants a lullaby, somebody wants a different channel, somebody's dealing with their first heartbreak, and the dishes in the sink ain't gonna wash themselves. She lights a cigarette out on the balcony. When she gets a couple minutes to herself, there's how you plan it out and how it turns out to be. And a broken home, it ain't no fairy tale. She's got three kids, no husband, and a hairnet job at a diner. She knows damn well she don't make the best cup of coffee, but she's quick with a smile and good with names. And those lunch tickets ain't gonna tip themselves. She smokes a cigarette out by the loaded dock and tries not to pick the polish off her nails. She thinks about a guy who's been coming in a lot. She starts to dream and then she stops herself. She's
got three kids, no husband. So she's a mom and a dad and a taxi driver. When the baby's sick, she's an up all nighter, a hand and a shoulder and a referee. A real life hero if you ask me, 'cause those kids ain't gonna raise themselves.
Wow, that song is incredible. Three kids and no husband. How do you relate to that song?
I grew up, probably most people would consider it poor. I didn't, because I didn't know any different. We always had whatever we needed, my brother and I, and my parents really sacrificed a lot to make sure we also had what we wanted. And I didn't grow up around anybody who had money. Everybody was sort of in the same boat. And so there wasn't a class system in that way in my hometown. When I moved to Nashville, I definitely saw, oh, wow, there are some people who grew up in mansions as opposed to, you know, like a mobile home. When I write or sing about that, it's not because I think, oh, it'd be cool to write a song about people who are living week to week, you know? I mean, that's still me in a lot of ways. And so I understand that struggle.
When you travel around and sing in these places and go back to your hometown, what do you see?
Well, you know, it does feel like sometimes that, you know, small town America is really struggling financially. I don't think they're struggling otherwise. I mean, I think small towns will always be the heartbeat of this country. I just think whenever there's a recession or something that hits our country, I feel like small towns get hit the hardest because it's a lot of mom and pop sort of places. And sometimes those things just don't survive.
Some would say that white working class towns like Morton or where I'm from, they're not going to recover. Like, they're done. Do you feel when you're writing these songs, and I know that songwriting is to heal and to express and to share, but do you ever feel like sometimes you're documenting the end of something?
Oh, wow. I hope not. I hope I'm just documenting a time in history. I personally don't think small towns will ever die. You know, I see a lot of people that I grew up with that are now the adults in the community and have kids that go to the school. And I think as long as there are people who stick around, small towns will be around. They oftentimes have to drive a couple hours to find work,
right?
Which isn't easy, but I think there's a lot of pride in small town America. And so for that reason, I think small town America will live on. I hope I'm not documenting the end of it. That would be very sad. You know, I think that, like I said, I feel like it's the heartbeat of our country.
Hey, you know, we've had such a deep, heavy interview, which is great, and I think it's really beautiful, but you have such great songs that made me laugh so hard out loud. Do you mind ending with a song with a chuckle?
we'll leave you with something lighthearted.
All right, thank you.
One, two, three.
When you broke my heart, I wanted to cut the brake line on your four-wheel drive and poison your pap's blue ribbon. When you drug my name all through the mud, I was dying to do the same, but I held my tongue, 'cause that ain't Christian. And you might be laughing now, but what goes around comes around. So I hope you have a daughter.
Daughter by Brandi Clark from her album Big Day in a Small Town. Charles Monroe Kane sat down with her. After the interview, Brandi played a few more songs, which are also pretty stunning. Check them out if you want at ttbook.org.
Yeah, karma's a bitch, so I hope you have a daughter.
Sometimes, recorded live in studio means you get to sit next to one of the great contemporary jazz musicians at his piano backstage. That's how Steve Paulson met Vijay Iyer. Here's a short excerpt from their encounter, which happened a few years ago, back when Steph Curry was dominating basketball with his three-point shooting.
We've been trained to believe that improvisation is rare and scarce and strange, rather than so omnipresent it's actually kind of banal. But when you bring that sensibility of, like, how do we do everyday life, then to your instrument, you just bring that same sensibility, like, well, what should I play next? Or what note should I play now? I wonder what happens if I put these two things together. you know, we could talk about a game of basketball, mm-hmm. right? Which is a highly regulated situation where every step you make and every move you make and how long you can hold the ball and whom you pass it to and when, and you're under surveillance, right? And there's only a handful of options you have at any moment. And yet the outcome of every game is unforeseen.
And the players we tend to celebrate the most are those who exercise the most creativity.
In the moment.
In the moment, yeah.
Those extreme conditions of...
And there are obvious benefits. You're harder to guard if you can do the unpredictable.
For example, yeah.
We've just witnessed Steph Curry.
Yes, indeed we have. That was the reason I brought it up. Right. So, you know, that's an example where you could say it's just a tremendous staged improvisation that has a lot of rules that govern the moment to moment, but also from moment to moment, we don't actually know what's about to happen. Hmm. So music is not so different.
You are sitting at a piano right now. We were just talking about Steph Curry. He just had this amazing game last night. Yeah. Does anything come to mind musically? Just a few.
Oh, no.
Basketball? I'm guessing you're a basketball fan.
There was a tune I wrote. You know, actually, some years ago, I was invited. I don't know why, but I wrote a bunch of tunes for ESPN.
Really? ESPN? How did that?
That's right. That was Harvard professor?
Did they use them?
I am not aware of them having used them, but they liked them. And I think it was, I'm not sure what happened, but they commissioned a little, like, basically an album's worth of 2-minute cues.
Wow. Do you remember any of those?
Yeah.
Could you play one?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was for a band. I mean, basically they wanted something like small, fast, and loose, something that sounded like improvisation. So I made one. Called The Prowl. I don't know if I can play it, really. But it was just about the way people move on the court. Huh. I can't play it, but I'll try. I can't. Let's see.
Thank you.
That was just, that wasn't even really it. At some point I realized, I don't actually know how this goes. So
I guess it illustrates what we were just talking about. But I love, and you said that was, you called that The Prowl.
Yes, I did.
Which, I mean, I had the sense of there was stalking going on at the beginning, and then there was almost the pounce, and then this cacophony of stuff happened.
Well, just sort of like rough and tumble atmosphere. Uh-huh. So it's sort of about finding a balance or a a way to move with grace and fluidity in the midst of what seems like a stressful situation.
Celebrated jazz pianist Vijay Iyer. Steve Paulson sat down with him backstage at the Union Theater in Madison, Wisconsin. One improvisation deserves another, so before we go, here's the beatboxing father-daughter combo Nicole Paris and Ed Cage. This is recorded from the stage of our live show in St. Louis. Father-daughter beatboxing team Nicole Paris and Ed Cage.
Jamaica style.
Okay, well, I hate to tell you, but that's it for our show today, which comes to you from a bunch of music lovers in Madison, Wisconsin. This week, Mark Rickers has The High Women on repeat, the debut album of the all-women country supergroup. Joe Hartke's listening to the latest from Fiona Apple. Angelo Bautista is dancing in his kitchen to the new Dua Lipa album. Steve, the jazz fan, is listening to Alone Together and remembering the brilliant alto saxophonist Lee Konitz, who died last week from COVID. Shannon Henry Cliver is listening to a group she was supposed to see live, New Orleans rock band The Revivalists. Charles Monroe Kane, who put this hour together, is embarrassed to admit that he is listening to none other than Ted Nugent. Yes, and I am enjoying the sound of silence. Not the song, the real thing. From everyone here at To the Best of Our Knowledge, enjoy the music, whatever your taste.
PRX.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU in KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. Online at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us here on a Sunday morning. This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on After the Harvest, introducing UP, or Urban Produce Push, with a goal to provide produce to the people in pantries in every corner of Kansas City. More details on how to help at aftertheharvestkc.org. I have 92 today in Northeast and East Central Kansas. Tonight, 20% chance of showers. You're listening to KPR.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis.
And I'm Peter Sagal. Just when everything seemed lost for Democrats, a new hero arose. It's like the end of Avengers Endgame, but instead of the assembled heroes, it's just one 59-year-old lawyer in a pantsuit who emerges. We'll ask about this twist middling, plus feminist punk icon Kathleen Hanna tells us all the things that she is rebelling against now. And Bill Curtis tells us about the spot that tingles when his anchorman sense tells him news is happening.
Where your butt meets your thigh.
We'll ask what's really going on down there on our quiz right after this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The strike on the Israeli-Lebanese border yesterday that killed 12 children and young adults has renewed fears of a possible war in northern Israel with the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. Israel blames Hezbollah for the attack, but the group has denied this. NPR's Adil El-Shalchi reports the strike is also increasing tensions with Iran.
The strike on the Druze town of Majd al-Shams in the Israeli-controlled Golan Heights was the deadliest attack on Israel along the northern border of Lebanon since the beginning of the war in Gaza. Iran warned of potential, quote, unprecedented consequences if Israel unleashed an unusually forceful response to the rocket strike. This came as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu landed back in Israel after a trip to the U.S. where he addressed Congress and met with President Biden and Donald Trump. Yesterday, Netanyahu said that Hezbollah would, quote, pay a heavy price for the attack. His defense minister, Yoav Gallant, also said that Hezbollah will pay a price for this loss. Early this morning, the Israeli military said it struck a number of Hezbollah targets in Lebanese territory. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Ramallah.
More than 100 active wildfires are burning more than 2 million acres across the western U.S. The biggest one is in Northern California, but cooler, wetter weather has helped firefighters. The blaze is now about 12% contained. NPR's Amy Held reports.
Authorities say an accused arsonist pushed a burning car into a gully in Chico last week, sparking the park fire. That's burned more than 300,000 acres, forcing thousands to evacuate, including residents of the rebuilt town of Paradise. 6 years after it was destroyed by the campfire. Jen Robbins lost everything then. Now she has again fled the flames, leaving it all behind.
Not knowing if the home we built is existing, not knowing if my livelihood of these farm animals, if they're even alive. There's a lot of guilt. There's a lot of pain.
Dozens of other wildfires have choked the air in the Pacific Northwest. Hot and dry conditions are leading to critical fire weather in the central U.S. as climate change is making large destructive wildfires more likely. Amy Held, NPR News.
It is 100 days to Election Day, and both sides are making their respective cases. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, a Democrat, says Donald Trump, a Republican, didn't live up to his promises when he was president.
He broke his promise for that kind of economic growth. He broke his promise to pass an infrastructure bill, right? He said he would do that. He failed to do it. The Biden-Harris administration got it done. He even broke his promise to that January 6th mob when he said, I will be at your side when you march down to the Capitol. But he actually did keep two promises. He kept his promise to destroy the right to choose in this country, and he kept his promise on tax cuts for the rich.
Buttigieg was interviewed on Fox News Sunday. This is NPR News in Washington. Venezuela is electing a president today. Nicolas Maduro is seeking another six-year term, his third. His main opponent is retired diplomat Edmundo Gonzalez. The opposition leader, Marina Corina Machado, was banned from running for president and is leading the fight against Maduro. A major issue is the economy. In recent years, nearly 8 million people have left Venezuela to seek a better life elsewhere. One of the world's most famous ancient roads has been added to the United Nations list of World Heritage Sites. As Villa Marx reports, the Via Appia is the 60th site in Italy to be recognized.
The Via Appia runs more than 400 miles south from Rome, and its construction more than 2,000 years ago was considered a major feat of civil engineering before subsequent extensions down to the southeast tip of Italy as the Roman Empire expanded. Built for the Roman military to move quickly, it became a model for road building across the Mediterranean. It's still standing and is considered the oldest road of Rome. The World Heritage Committee voted to add it to the global list alongside other sites, including a national park in Malaysia and an archaeological region in Saudi Arabia. Italy's culture ministry cheered the Via Appia's inclusion coming less than a year after Italian opera was added to the UNESCO list as a more intangible cultural treasure. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx.
French authorities say rail service has been fully restored after last week's disruption. A coordinated attack paralyzed the country's high-speed network hours before Friday's ceremony opening the Paris Olympics, canceling trains and interrupting international service. Investigators are still trying to determine who is behind the sabotage. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
I'm Maria Lopez. Now here's your weather forecast for the KPR listening area.
It's 79 and mostly cloudy. Wind is from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. A few showers today with a high in the low 90s. Tonight, thunderstorms with a low in the mid-70s. Then tomorrow, clear with a high around 102. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-70s. It's 79 and mostly cloudy. Stay tuned for more KPR weather for Northeast Kansas.
The following program was taped in front of an audience of real live people.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm the man with a gold medal in voice gymnastics. Bill Curtis, and here is your host at the Studebaker Theater at the Fine Arts Building in Chicago, Illinois, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. Oh, thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. It's really great to be back with you. Later on, we're going to be talking today to Kathleen Hanna of the feminist punk band Bikini Kill. They are touring again this summer, 34 years after the band was founded. We'll ask her what it's like to have to get your doctor's permission before you jump into the mosh pit. But first, we want to hear your anthem of rebellion. Give us a call to play our games. The number is 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Mary Cryan from Old Mystic, Connecticut.
Now, I happen to know Old Mystic, having been there.
No way.
Yeah, way. And what do you do there?
I'm actually a nuclear test engineer in a small shipyard in Groton, Connecticut.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
That's where they build our nuclear subs. So when you say you're a nuclear test engineer, does like do they turn on the nuclear engine, you have to go down there for a while, and you come back, and if you're fine, it's working?
It's a terrific savings in light bulbs.
Exactly. Well, welcome to the show, Mary. Let me introduce you to our panel this week. First up, she is the creator and showrunner of Girls 5 Eva, a fabulous show, all three seasons of which are on Netflix. It's Meredith Scardino. Next, a writer and actor who can be seen at the Williamstown Theater Festival July 30th and 31st in the new play Marcel on the Train. It's Peter Gross.
Hi.
And a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning and author of the New York Times best-selling Rocktogenarians, Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks and Triumphs, it's Mo Rocca.
Hi, Mary.
So, Mary, of course you're going to start us off with Who's Bill This Time. Bill Curtis is going to read you three quotations we found in this week's news. Your job, correctly identify or explain just two of them. Do that, you won our prize, the voice of anyone you might choose for your own purposes, whatever they may be. All right.
Okay.
Ready to go?
Yes.
All right. Your first quote is an official message delivered from a presidential campaign officially on Thursday.
Trump is old and quite weird.
That is the shift in tone we're seeing now that who is the likely Democratic nominee for president?
Vice President Kamala Harris.
Yes, indeed, Kamala Harris. Biden is out. Kamala is in, and Democrats are really jazzed. It's not about Harris potentially being the first female president or the first South Asian president. It's about her being a president we don't have to worry about on the stairs. Democrats are just an amazing change of mood because they finally have the candidate they want. Anybody else.
And she'll also be, wouldn't she be the first brat president?
As yes. Everyone's
saying. Yes.
Yes, she is the first brat president, or so she was called by Charlie, help me out, XCX.
Right.
She said, Kamala is brat, and this apparently won her the youth vote for reasons I'm incapable of understanding.
I've been enjoying watching, like, all the pundits talk about, like, now our young, of course, someone young in the office told us what brat is, and just like going and trying to figure it out.
It's very sad.
The funny thing is also it's like it's kind of like a messy party girl a little bit who makes some mistakes.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you tell someone that, then they're like, Oh, so it was, they don't like, she doesn't like her? She doesn't like Kamala Harris? And then it's like, no, that's a compliment.
Yeah, it's a compliment.
It's a compliment.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
And she has to win Wisconsin, a swing state, and over there they might think she meant she's a brat.
Well, no, but it's actually, it's so interesting you mentioned Wisconsin because she loves butter. Like, these cooking videos are amazing, and there's a video.
Kamala loves butter?
She loves butter. Like, there's a great video of her telling someone off camera, she didn't realize she was on camera, how to make a Thanksgiving turkey, and she just goes all in on the butter. And then in a recent cookie baking video, it's the same thing. And I thought that is such a great swing state strategy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Do you think she's taking, like, big butter kickbacks?
Yeah. Awesome. Now, the question is, of course, everybody's talking about now. We have to talk about something, is who Kamala Harris is going to pick as her running mate. And everybody thinks, of course,
Joe Biden.
But
that would be a twist.
That would be amazing.
Because no one has said he's too old to be vice president.
That's true.
Vice president doesn't matter. We all know it doesn't matter.
Could be a butter Joe Biden. You know, carved out of butter.
Butter Biden. Build back better, butter Biden.
All right. Your next quote is from a disappointed frequent flyer on Southwest Airlines.
This is the end of the People's Airline.
That person was talking about what big change from Southwest that they announced this week.
Oh, yeah, no more just pick your own seat.
Yeah, they're switching to assigned seating like all the old boring airlines. Southwest is finally getting rid of its trademark first-come, first-served seating plan. Now it's just like any other airline. They're even changing their slogan, you know, you are now free to move about the country. Now it's Southwest, free will is an illusion.
They're going to get pilots now, too, I heard.
Yeah, really. as opposed to whoever's like the first in line, boarding group A, you get the seat way up front.
But wait, so the person from that quote is like, oh, it's all over? The people enjoyed fighting for their seats?
People loved it. One Southwest passenger told the Washington Post, quote, I woke up to a ton of texts from friends giving me the news. And another said he liked the old system because he was a, quote, dedicated middle seat enthusiast.
I feel like he's going to be fine.
You think he's going to be fine?
It's still the worst seat. You're always going to be able to get that seat.
Yeah.
The guy who said he was a middle seat enthusiast, he has a friend?
Yeah.
Like, because if he had a friend,
like,
he wouldn't need to sit in the middle seat to meet
people.
Yeah,
or just, I don't
know. You know, doesn't that sound a little bit like some kind of pervert euphemism?
A middle seat enthusiast? Yeah.
Now, what's interesting, Meredith, is apparently they're not doing it to earn more money to compete with the, you know, as they call them, the legacy airlines like United and American and Delta. They're doing it, they say, because the other competing cheap airlines are beating them on price, and they need to compete with them. And Spirit Airlines is like, oh, you're getting rid of open seating? Fine. We're getting rid of seats. All right. Here is your last quote. It's from the New York Times about where some people need to apply deodorant now.
Where your butt meets your thigh.
Like a big pizza pie, that's amore. No, that was not amore. That was the Times giving romance advice because what is making dating much harder than it was?
Oh, the heat.
Yeah, the heat because of climate change, right? That's the answer. The New York Times says that climate change is ruining dating because it's making us all sweaty and gross all the time.
This article was written by a guy who's would be sweaty and gross
probably
in 10-degree colder weather.
Yes. This is why I can't get a date.
This is happening to everyone that I've talked to in my apartment.
But you know...
I'm a middle seat enthusiast.
I was going to say, middle seat guy doesn't mind.
The Times, well, remember, this is service journalism, so they have solutions for you daters out there who are dealing with the heat. Apply deodorant liberally, especially to that spot. Choose indoor activities for your date. And most importantly, only sleep with them on a first date if they have air conditioning.
It's also funny that that's the spot that they picked as a place to apply deodorant. I mean...
Where your butt meets your thumb.
Your butt meets your thigh.
I'm just going to say, that place does get damp.
Yeah. Is there going to be a whole...
It's fine now. Don't worry about it. But I just want you to know, in theory.
What about like in... You know, how are things in Norway?
Exactly.
Or somewhere where it's like a little cooler? Is it just Shag City?
Nothing's getting in the way.
Oh, you mean what they used to call Oslo, now Shag City? Yeah, I got it.
Bill, how did Mary do in our quiz?
Like a mushroom cloud. She blew the roof off and won three in a row.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you. Oh!
Right now, panel, we have some questions for you. And first, it's a game that we're going to call...
The Race for the Bronze. Because let's not kid ourselves.
So the Olympic Games in Paris have now begun, and we are going to ask you about some events that are happening there. Rapid fire, true, false style. So if you get yours right, you get a point. Here we go. Mo, true or false, after reports that the Paris Olympic Village would be furnished with, quote, cardboard anti-sex beds, an Olympic gymnast posted a video showing that you could, in fact, have sex in the beds.
I'm going to say true.
That is true. Meredith, true or false, he did it by having sex on the bed.
True.
No, it's false.
Ah!
He just did somersaults in the bed, but no guarantees if that's not how you have sex.
Peter, true. Stick the landing.
Yeah. Sorry. Peter, true or false, yes. The first American torchbearer in the torch relay was a first responder who had rescued victims of recent tornadoes in Ohio.
True.
No, it's false. The first American torchbearer was the senior executive vice president of customer offers and order processing at Best Buy.
So inspiring.
And Peter, true or false, after injuring his ring finger practicing for the Olympics, Australian field hockey player Matthew Dawson had to miss out on the games.
I'm going to say false.
It is false because he had the doctors amputate the finger so he didn't have to miss the games.
Wait, say the first part of it again?
So, yeah.
What was the problem?
So he injured his finger, his ring finger.
Do you know how?
Presumably playing field hockey.
Okay.
Apparently it was a choice between missing the games and letting his finger heal or cutting it off and going. So he went.
Wow.
Anyway, that does it for our 2024 Paris Olympics preview. Remember, it's not about winning or losing. It's really only about winning. And also, if you have recently voluntarily amputated your finger, do not swim in the River Seine. Coming up, our panel.